Hello and welcome to day 3 of our coverage of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology annual meeting. By now I'm sure you're all familiar with the format these episodes are taking, so I'll keep this introduction brief and we'll get stuck into the interviews. So please keep listening, please keep commenting, and I hope you're all enjoying the coverage. So we're now with Paul Barrett of the Natural History Museum, and he's been looking at feathers in dinosaurs and which dinosaurs may or may not have had them. Could you tell us a bit more about this, please?
Sure. What we've been looking into is what type of skin did dinosaurs have? So there are a lot of recent discoveries of dinosaurs with feathers, and there are a number of other feather-like structures on some dinosaurs too, things that have variously been called filaments, very short, simple structures, and also things that have been called quills, these very long, slender structures on the tails of some bird-hip dinosaurs. And because of all of these new discoveries, a number of our colleagues have suggested that maybe dinosaurs as a whole were actually characterised by some kind of fuzzy coating, and in a few dinosaurs that fuzzy coating then goes on to form feathers. And it's fairly uncontroversial that a lot of dinosaurs close to bird origins had things that look like proper feathers. And it's also fairly uncontroversial that some of their more primitive relatives had filaments covering their body. What's slightly more controversial is this claim that this feature characterises the entire group of dinosaurs, so that it's not just part of the origin of bird story, but it's part of the dinosaur story as a whole, which would make dinosaurs very unusual among reptiles because they would be the only ones that would be walking around with some evidence of a kind of fuzzy skin. So what our study has been about is looking at the skin structure of as many different dinosaurs as we could find, looking what sorts of skin structures they had preserved with their skeletons, and then trying to work out what the evolutionary history of those structures were to see if they really are common to all dinosaurs or if only a small subgroup of dinosaurs really have those features.
And what were you able to work out?
So what we found was that, yeah, there is very good evidence that feathers and feather-like structures characterise those dinosaurs very close to the origin of birds, the dinosaurs we call theropod dinosaurs, things like T-Rex and so on. A lot of those animals, it's very clear they did have this kind of dino fuzz over them or feathers. But when we go further down the family tree of dinosaurs and we look at the other big groups of dinosaurs, the long-necked sauropods and also the plant-eating bird-hip dinosaurs, although there are one or two very rare examples in those groups of animals with possibly filament or feather-like structures, they seem to be potentially different from those we see in the other animals, and there simply aren't enough of them to infer that actually this is part of dinosaur evolutionary history in general. Instead, what it seems to be is that dinosaurs were primitively scaly animals, like all other reptiles. Those scales are there in the long-necked sauropods and also in these plant-eating bird-hip dinosaurs, and early on in the evolutionary history of the theropod dinosaurs that give rise to birds. And it seems that theropod dinosaurs then go on to do crazy things with this and develop feathers and develop all these other structures, whereas most other dinosaur groups just stick with a very reptilian model after all. And the very rare occurrences we have of things like filaments are probably independent inventions of those things in those other groups rather than being part of the origin of bird story.
We're with Yoshi Kobayashi from Hokkaido University in Japan, and he's been looking at the first record of dinosaur nesting colonies from Mongolia. So could you tell us a little bit about these dinosaurs? What species were they, and what evidence have you got for them nesting?
We got this site in Mongolia, and this dinosaur called it Therizinosauroid. It's a group of theropod. It's a meat-eating dinosaur, meat-eating, but now we know that this dinosaur is herbivorous, so plant-eating dinosaur. And this dinosaur, in the latest time of the dinosaur age, they become pretty big. And the most famous dinosaur is the Therizinosaurus from Mongolia, but this place that we discovered this time, it's a little bit older than this Therizinosaurus time. So this site is roughly 80 million years ago, and we found this first evidence of Therizinosauroid nesting colony in Mongolia.
So a nesting colony, that sounds, I don't know, I've never really heard of dinosaurs nesting together. This sounds more like a bird trait.
There are some evidences for other dinosaurs like Hadrosaurus and sauropodomorphs, but not in a theropod dinosaur. So this is the first. Excuse me. There are two cases. One in Montana, the other one in Portugal. So this is the third evidence of theropod colony in the world. So they are there, but this is it's very rare to find a theropod colony.
So what can we learn about their ecology through this nesting site?
Because we found this colony, so there are many nests in that area. So we found 18 nests, and we sort of made a calculation how many nests could be there if the colony is really complete, because there are some areas eroded away. So we made a calculation, so in the estimate is maybe 56 nests in that area. So there are many nests in a small area. So they were together. So they lived together, and they laid eggs together, and they protect the egg nest to increase surviving rate.
So how do you know it was a therizontosaurid rather than any other animal? Were they associated bones with the colony?
There, if you look at the shell, the eggshell structure, sometimes you can tell what kind of dinosaur it is. There is one. There are some specimens from China that eggs with embryonic bones inside. So comparing the egg structure that we found to this Chinese specimen with embryo, so we can identify this egg, eggs that we found belong to Therizinosaur dinosaur.
Do you have any evidence that perhaps that could just be one individual repeatedly visiting the same site over and over again and just making a nest in different locations?
We made this look at the rocks section, see how depositional environment, and looking at the sections, it looks like these nests are laid pretty much in a single occasion. So it's hard to imagine one Therizinosaur just came back to the same site and did that, you know, all the work. So it's we assume that it's a part of Therizinosaurs were there.
Well, Yoshi, thanks very much. Well,
thank you.
So I'm here looking at Christian Heck's poster, and he's looking at egg deformation in eggs from China. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what happens to an egg when it's buried?
So the eggs that we took a look at least, they show, well, first off, we're assuming that they're buried upon nest, in their nest. And what we're seeing is overlying sediment comes over the nest and causes kind of this one-sided crushing. So we see sediment infilling into the egg through cracks that are forming when that overburden occurs. And it kind of stabilizes the bottom, making it round. And then before the sediment can reach the top collapses in. And so it leaves these distinct marks, this thing called a compression ridge, which goes along the entire circumference of the egg, which kind of shows it's parallel to the bedding plane, is what we see. And then the crushed side is going to be the top of the egg, and the rounded is the bottom. And it's kind of all important from what we see, because in many museums, commercial paleontology is a big thing, unfortunately. And so we always get specimens that are lacking data. We don't know their orientation. They just kind of show up. And this gives us, like, a tool for orienting these eggs. We observe some eggs out in the field that clearly show this trend where crushed is up, rounded is bottom. And so now we can use this as kind of a first step to doing research on these eggs. We can orient them. We can say which way is up. We have clusters that all show the same deformation pattern. And we can, future researchers will hopefully be able to use this to their advantage in analyzing these eggs.
So if you get a chicken egg, for example, and try and squash it, if you squeeze it from the sides, it will break a lot easier than if you squeeze it from its ends. So does it matter what shape the egg is?
I think so, because the only the eggs that we see really exhibit this pattern clearly. And these are called spirolithus. It's a bit of a mouthful, but they're more oval-shaped. I don't know. They're hard to explain, kind of. They're spheres. And so we believe that, I mean, that leads to them being able to get crushed like they do, as well as the fact that just a single crack can just collapse the entire structure in on itself. And that's all it would take for these eggs.
Do you know which animal these eggs are from?
They're believed to be from sauropods. Sauropods, or I believe hadrosaurs, but I'm fairly certain it's sauropods, definitely.
So I've got here Anna Holden from the Natural History Museum of LA County, and she's been looking at the insect damage that you get in Rancho La Brea.
That's correct. So I pretty much begged my way into a job at the tar pits to work on the insect collection, which I don't think had been studied much for decades. I mean, we had some people come in there, but in all seriousness, it hadn't been researched or published since about the 1980s. And there was a lot of discussion at the tar pits of how can we reconstruct the Pleistocene. And my argument was, well, you need the insects, because they didn't migrate. They have short life cycles. They lived right there. And they have, you know, maybe host plant associations, or we know what their climate restrictions. There's a lot to be gleaned. And while I was there, I got some temporary funds to work on the insect collection. It was brought to my attention that there were bones that had insect damage. And how they were presented to me was, there are bones that had dermestid damage. And I said, well, how do you know it's dermestid? So that's what started this whole study. I thought it was a little premature to attribute the kind of damage that was on the bones to a particular type of beetle. And so I worked with different people, and we established larval colonies and fed them bones to see if they would feed on it or not, and to see what the traces look like. And it was very interesting. One type of beetle was not known for making traces. In fact, it was thought never to eat bone, and it did, and it made a very distinct trace. And the dermestid beetles also make a very distinct trace, and the damage that was found on the tar pit bones was not always dermestid. And then there was this additional damage that we don't know what it is. I can't attribute it. Not yet. Probably because there's just millions of insects out there and there's just not enough research done. However, the damage that I was able to attribute were two types of insects that really like warm to hot climates. And we know enough about their life cycle to say that the carcasses that, you know, the bone that they fed on had to be above ground for a certain amount of time before it submerged. And at the tar pits, there are many remaining mysteries. No matter how famous it is, we don't know necessarily about the taphonomy. That's how things became fossilized and, you know, how they ended up. You know, we have these carcasses where the bones were distributed, you know, within the tar pits. We don't have individuals that are, you know, like most fossils, you see most of an individual. Tar pits, you might just get like one element or one kind of bone. So we don't know what happened. But these insects are saying that it was really kind of warm to hot, more than one would associate with the ice age. And it was warm to hot for quite a while. So this was a big finding. And I hope that it will also promote some more research into, you know, the different types of insects that will eat bone, because one of the insects, the tenebrionids, were not known to eat bone. And in the other literature, they say, you know, it can only be, you know, only certain kinds of insects. As an entomologist, my gosh, there's so many possibilities that we haven't studied. So how can anybody say that? So it helps us understand, you know, what the temperature was like.
In terms of the preservation method of vertebrate material in La Brea, I was under the understanding that it was really rapid. But if you're having to get these insects into the bone, is there some kind of decay on top of the surface of the tar pit first that exposes the bones to the insects?
In a way, in order for... Well, our theory is that because it only occurred in herbivore and juvenile. Now, herbivores have a lot thicker skin than carnivore. And believe me, I mean, I spent weeks looking at carnivore bones. more than I would like to admit, looking at carnivore bones. But I only saw it in herbivores. Herbivores have this thick skin that can desiccate in the sun. Our likely theory is that carnivores, you know, ravage these herbivores and discard these leg bones because they're not the meatiest. They don't, you know, they don't have like the innards and the guts, like other desirable areas of the herbivores. But that created an opportunity for insects to lay their eggs in these like discarded legs. And that's where the larvae, you know, the eggs hatched and they turned to larvae and then they pupated. And while they were in there, they're in this protected environment where they fed on, you know, the subcutaneous tissue and eventually the bone and then turned into adults. But that would have taken a very long time. If the carcasses submerged very quickly, this wouldn't have been possible. Like, for instance, the darkling or Tenebriana beetles can live up to, 1 to 2 years before they turn into adults. You know, insects often, as their immature stages, live longer than the adult forms that we're familiar with. So it really did take a long time for it to submerge.
And the beetles themselves and all of these insects, if they're able to find these bones and they're about the area, wouldn't they also have fallen into the tar? Do you find any evidence for them?
Yes, absolutely. We have thousands of them. That's the thing, is for the Domestid and the Tenebrianas especially, we have thousands of specimens in our collection.
You sound happy about that.
Well, I am happy. But, yeah, they got caught too. I mean, I think they saw an opportunity and they often got stuck.
I'm so happy that I found another arthropod worker.
I mean, really, they had the opportunity to you know, modify the bones and create these traces. I can't say that they survived, you know, and passed that, but... They might have enjoyed it at immature stages and never made it to adults.
All right. Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So.
I listened to your podcast. It was great.
You liked it. Thank you very much. Sorry, guys. Just got to deal with the fans.
Of course.
So.
Yeah, groupies.
Yeah. I've got David Gillette and Oscar Carranza, who've been looking at glyptodonts. Now, can you start off by explaining what a glyptodont is? Because it's not something I've ever really been overly familiar with.
A glyptodont is a relative of armadillos that, instead of having a movable shell, has a rigid shell that resembles the shell of a turtle. It's a mammal, but this rigid shell gave it protection and... allowed this animal to move through difficult terrain. The shell is composed of a series of interlocking plates called osteoderms that as adults locked and made the shell rigid. They were plant eaters and they were restricted to tropical and subtropical conditions. Probably lived a lot in water. And they were as big as a Volkswagen Beetle.
I didn't realize the scale of that.
Yeah, these were really large animals, and they were protected with this shell from predators that lived in the same area. We know one glyptodont skull that has holes in the frontal bones on top of the skull that were made by a saber-toothed cat. That one's on display at the American Museum of Natural History.
And he just worked it off.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so when did these animals live, these glyptodonts?
In this genus lived in North America from about 4 million years ago, which we know from Mexico, until the extinction of the megafauna in North America about 11,000 years ago. So they were here for about 4 million years.
Okay, and your poster is describing a new juvenile specimen, is it?
Well, we've collected lots of information for this study. That includes a baby and young juvenile and old juvenile and adults.
That over there is a juvenile.
And so we've been able to understand the growth series, and that in turn allows us to evaluate the taxonomy. And so we're now synonymizing two species that were previously thought to be different that turn out to be the same species. And that helps in understanding their evolution.
So it was just one was an adult, one was a juvenile, and there's differences between those. So they were separated as two species, but they're actually baby and adult.
Right. Well, juvenile and adult, and the baby helps us understand the growth series. And we can also recognize males and females. That helped again in the evaluation of the species. So where we thought we had two species, now we recognize we have one, and this is a species that lived from 4 million years ago until 2 million years ago, and it didn't change over a 2 million year span of time. That's unusual for vertebrate animals. We usually see more evolution over that long a span of time than what we're seeing in glyptodonts.
The diamondfish, sexual diamondfish, we recognized very recently. This is a new knowledge, new discoveries, comparing the material from 111 Ranch.
That's in Arizona, yeah. So we're using data from both areas, Mexico and southeastern Arizona, to compare information. So we've been looking forward to this collaboration for a long time, and it's finally borne fruit.
Okay, so just getting it, in Arizona you've got differences between juveniles and adults, and then between locations, so in Arizona and Mexico, and there's a temporal difference there of 2 million years, was
that? 2 million years.
And
right.
So do you get the not much of a difference between Arizona and Mexico?
Absolutely none. We don't see any difference in morphology, so we're proposing that there was no evolution during that period of time. This species did not change over a 2 million year period. I think that also means that the habitat did not change over a 2 million year period. Distribution did, as the habitat positions changed, but the habitat itself was unchanging as a reflection of the glyptodonts that lived there. And it probably lived in water. It's more like an aquatic animal than a terrestrial one. So
the riparian ecology, close to the river, close to the ravines, and swamps, something like that, where they can get soft plants.
I think they lived in ponds and swamp and wet, very wet areas. Very different from southeastern Arizona today. Very different from central Mexico
too.
Oscar's area is a dry scrub area, desert conditions, much like we have today in Arizona. Both of them differ from the way it was 4 million years ago.
It's impossible for this animal to live in Arizona or in Mexico, in central Mexico now. Impossible.
So is that why it went extinct, do you think?
I think they went extinct because of climate change at the end of the Ice Age, when the climate became severe and climatic conditions fluctuated faster than these animals could adjust their ranges. So that may explain their extinction. Other people say that the megafauna was brought to extinction by humans, and I don't think there's any evidence for that with glyptodonts.
I wouldn't fancy eating a giant Volkswagen Beetle either.
There's actually some evidence of glyptodonts living at the same time as people in South America. There's one case where people are proposed to have lived as inside a carapace as shelter. So people were using a carapace as a place to be protected from the elements.
Kind of like a Volkswagen Beetle shaped igloo.
Yeah, that's right.
Or the carapace maybe is bigger than this.
Yeah, pretty big.
So several small
people
could get inside. Yeah, about 2 meters long, or up to 2 meters long and a meter high. So what you're looking at is a big animal with a very strong shell, and as a place to seek shelter, that would be very effective. Not in North America, though, so we don't see any indication of humans and glyptodonts in North America.
South America. Only in South America.
Okay, thanks very much, guys. So we're joined by Rui Castanina from the Museo de Lurinha. Is that pronunciation good?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, and you've been looking at a new fossil site in Mozambique, is that right?
Yeah, it's not only me, it's a big team that is involved on these recent discoveries in Mozambique. And we have been collecting early synapsids from the late Permian of Mozambique, yeah.
So a synapsid is a kind of early mammal relative?
Well, you and I are synapsids.
Right,
so
okay.
All mammals, from the bats to the blue whale, we are all synapsids. But during evolution, the majority of synapsids got extinct. There's a lot of different extinct lineages of synapsids. And some of the ones that we are studying are currently found in the north part of Mozambique. So we are talking about very basal forms of synapsids that got extinct but are still very close related to our modern mammal lineages.
So these fossils that you're finding, are they pretty well preserved? Are they lots of them?
There's two things that I have to say about it. Well, the first one is that they are pristinely preserved. That's not the full rule in the field. Of course, we have exceptions. And the second thing is that we almost only find skulls. That's typical from a lot of Karoo sites. Karoo, it's a period that corresponds to a lot of different ages in Africa. And we have a lot of skulls. So, for instance, just to give you a comparison, I came from Portugal and we have a lot of material, vertebrate fossil material from Portugal, but we don't have one single complete skull. And you can name it, dinosaurs, crocodiles, turtles, you name it. From the Jurassic, we have none. From the Paleozoic, we have none also. Maybe some fish. In Mozambique, in like three or four expeditions, we found more than 20 independent and really well-preserved skulls. This gives you an idea of the richness of the place in Mozambique.
So with the special preservation, is there anything that you can tell about these animals that we didn't know before?
So we CT'd one of the skulls that we have now. We are planning to do two more skulls. And actually it turned out that we have a new species and a new genus that is that was found on North Mozambique. It will be published very soon with a new name. It will be called Niasodon Mfumukazi.
And, oh, that's nice and easy.
Niasodon, Niasa, it's the province where it was found. Don means tooth. And Mfumukazi, it's the local name for queen. It's a homage that we pay to the traditional way of organizing the society in Mozambique, because in the north part of Mozambique, it's women who rule. So everything is matrilineally transmitted. So women rule the family, get the job. And actually, we decided to give a female name to our specimen. We were not sure if it's a female or a male, but in case of doubt, we are assuming that this fossil is a female.
So it's the equivalent of Rex and Tarantulas.
Yeah, exactly. So it would be the queen of the Niassa Lake. Okay, that's our homage that we are going to pay. Niasodon Mfumukazi.
So these fossils that you're getting, why have we not heard anything about fossils of this kind coming out of Mozambique before? I've not really heard of Mozambique as a particularly fossil-rich area. Is this really because people didn't know that you could get the fossils in the rocks, or just that they hadn't found them yet?
I think it's a matter of lack of working in the field. People know that there are some outcrops there, and people know for, I would say, more than 50 years that probably we have very good material coming from the north of Mozambique. The problem is that to go to Mozambique, you have to know the place. It's not work in Africa, is not easy. And actually, we are the first painstaking paleontological expedition ever conducted in Mozambique. So this, we are going there for the last 4 or 5 years, every year. So that means that there's a lot of to explore, a lot of to discover, and Mozambique is, we are just uncovering just the tip of the veil. There's a lot of work to do, really.
So is there any infrastructure in Mozambique to help you? I mean, in terms of getting the fossils out of the rock, you're then however many thousand miles away from Portugal.
Yeah.
Is there any museums in Mozambique that can help you out?
Actually, this project is more Mozambican than Portuguese. It's a Mozambican project with a lot of international collaboration. We have like three main people that are coordinating the project. It's myself, Ricardo Araújo, and Luís Costa Júnior. Luís Costa Júnior is the director of the National Museum of Geology in Maputo. This means that the project is being coordinated by three people in three different continents, actually. I'm in Europe, in Portugal. Ricardo is in Dallas, in the US. And Luis is in Maputo, in Africa. So every year we go to the field together, we do everything together, and everything is being done with the authorities from Mozambique. So it's actually a Mozambican project.
So do you think this project will help Mozambique develop into a paleontological active country?
Actually, our goal is to transform Mozambique into one of the most important countries in terms of research in paleontology. That's our long-term goal. We want to... There's no reason why Mozambique cannot be one of the most important countries in terms of research of paleontology. They have the fossils, they have the people, they have the money, and they are interested in developing this this type of science. And we are doing three things at the same time with our project. First, science. That's why we go there every year. We are collecting the fossils. All the fossils are Mozambican heritage. They will come back to Mozambique. And we are, at the same time, transmitting the know-how that we have to Mozambican students. So at this time, as we speak, there's two Mozambican students being trained in Portugal under our supervision to come back with the fossils to their country and to be able to study them without the fossils having to get out of the country. And the third pillar of our project is outreach and conservation of the heritage. So we are making a lot of effort publishing stuff in magazines like National Geographic or like you, or like yourself, transmitting what we are doing to everyone. And at the same time, we are building new facilities in Mozambique where all the fossils, when they came back, can be displayed and studied again there. We in the long term, we want to create a really good center with a lot of paleontologists, Mozambican paleontologists, that can study. And in the end, in the future, they might even come to Portugal or to the US or to the UK to study their fossils and to establish collaboration abroad. That's our goal. That's what we want to do in Mozambique.
And best of luck with it. Thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.